Hello and welcome to episode 117 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I am Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a policy analyst, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Today's episode is my interview with Mark Bookman about his book, A Descending Spiral, Exposing the Death Penalty in 12 Essays. Mark Bookman is the executive director for the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation, a nonprofit that provides services for those facing possible execution. Before that, he spent many years in the homicide unit of the Defender Association of Philadelphia. He is also the author of a new book, A Descending Spiral, Exposing the Death Penalty in 12 Essays. Welcome to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Mark Bookman.
Thanks for having me, Josh. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. I always ask the same first question. How did you get from wherever you started in life to where you were defending people facing death sentences and ultimately writing a book, Taking on the Death Penalty?
So, you know, I've listened to your podcast, which is terrific. And so I knew that that was the first question. And even even being prepared with knowing that that's the first question, I don't feel like I have a remarkable answer. I grew up in an upper middle class suburban town. My father was a CPA. My brother was a CPA. My mom was a homemaker. I can't actually put my finger on anything that would have led me to this destination, other than the fact that it's always struck me as just about the most important thing I can do. And, I was always interested in writing, spent a lot of time writing. I used to publish short stories non-prolifically for years. And then I started writing this, what I would consider creative nonfiction. And at the same time, you know, I was a public defender for 28 years. And as a public defender, I was extremely ambitious, but in sort of a weird way that, you know, I never wanted to be anything other than a public defender, but I always wanted to do the most serious cases, the cases where the most was at risk. So, you know, kind of logically, these two things came together for me. That's my origin story.
That makes me wonder, you know, I mean, doing the most important case or the cases where the most is at stake, and being in a system where public defenders are not, you know, don't have the same resources, don't have the same system investigators, don't have the same situation. How were you able to survive that for so long? And what would you say kind of, I know there's a justice thing that keeps driving you, but there's also got to be a lot of stress and a lot of tension. And you know, what's kept you doing it for so long?
So there is huge stress and tension, but it's not exactly what you think. The Philadelphia Defender Association, I mean, there are many public defender offices that really struggle and are not handling these cases correctly. The Philadelphia Defender Association is not one of them. So when we started taking these cases in 1993, we took it under we made a very clear decision that if we were going to handle them, we were going to handle them correctly. And so we applied the ABA guidelines right from the start, two lawyers on every case, a mitigation specialist, a fact investigator, someone who was familiar with mental health. We were pretty well funded. And so the stress was always in the work, but never in the resources. And I'll go on to say that if your listeners take a look at the Yale Law Journal cannibalized a study by the RAND Corporation. What the RAND Corporation did was they looked at cases handled in Philadelphia from 1994 to 2005 from the public defender's office and court-appointed lawyers, because the public defender was handling one out of every five cases randomly. And what that study found is that if you were lucky enough to have a public defender in Philadelphia and you were facing homicide charges, you were, I want to make sure I get this right, 61% less likely to be convicted of first degree murder, 19% more likely to be acquitted, and overall your sentence was 24% lower if you had a public defender. So it really kind of blew up the presumption that the lawyer doesn't matter. You know, that study showed that the lawyer matters a lot more than the lawyer should matter. So, you know, I'm a proud ex-member of the Philadelphia Defender Association, and I guess I should also point out I'm on their board right now. So we handled them correctly from the beginning.
But my question was about how you deal with the stress and tension. And so, you know, I still want to answer that question because I think a lot of people who are public defenders and watch this would love to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I was hoping to get past that one, Josh.
Are you saying you haven't gotten past the stress and tension?
You caught me, apparently. So, you know, there's no getting around the stress and the tension. You know, if you're not feeling stress and tension, you're not in the moment. You're not paying attention, as they would say. So, you know, if you've assembled a strong team and you've got the best case you can get, then you have to live with that stress. There's nothing that's ever going to make you say, well, my client's life is at stake, but I'm not going to feel stress. That's an impossibility. You know, I guess you have to live with the consequences, and you hope your client lives with the consequences as well. And I mean that, you know, in a kind of a pun-like way. The stress is brutal, and frankly, I've always said that one of the biggest problems with the death penalty is we, the royal we, the public, we should not be in a position of making these decisions. That when you're trying to decide between life and death for another person, that's a decision that human beings simply shouldn't make. So that, you know, the stress that I feel, the stress that I hope jurors feel, or judges, or ideally prosecutors, it would occur to them that this is a decision nobody should be making. It's just as simple as that. And there are many reasons to oppose the death penalty, but that's one of them. What business do we have making this decision?
Recently, the Department of Justice put a moratorium on the use of the federal death penalty, but there was also some talk almost at the same time from the Biden DOJ about preserving the death penalty in the case of one of the Boston bombers. Coming after the tragedy of what happened in the last 2 years of the Trump administration, kind of rushing to get 13 executions done, in regards to the use of the federal death penalty, do you have kind of feelings about where we're at right now?
Yeah, you know, so federally, I think the Biden administration is finding its footing. You know, so let's leave the federal situation aside for just a minute. I mean, the lesson that is clearly learned, and you pointed it out in your question, is that another administration can come along and wreak complete havoc, like the Trump administration did. I mean, they put every due process consideration aside. I mean, they trampled on people's rights to achieve a goal of these 13 executions in 7 months, something absolutely unheard of federally, historically. That same lesson needs to be learned everywhere else. Like, for instance, in Pennsylvania, we've had a governor who instituted a moratorium, Governor Wolf. His second term is up soon, and we're going to have another governor. And that governor is going to, you know, make some life and death decisions. So, you know, where are we nationally? The trends are clearly in favor of moving past capital punishment. Death sentences are down, executions are down, moratoriums are up. The death penalty doesn't have the cachet that it used to have. So, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to see, you know, kind of, two steps forward and one step back, for lack of a better word. And we're going to continue to see that until we get to the end of the road. And the Trump administration brought that one home in a kind of powerful and horrifying way.
The book, let's kind of turn to the book. The book has kind of an interesting structure. What prompted you to utilize what I guess I would call an episodic format almost in the way that you wrote it?
Yeah. So, you know, I started writing these essays under one real theory, that the public, if they knew the truth about these issues, would not be in favor of the death penalty. So first of all, let me just say the public is not nearly as in favor of the death penalty as we think. The polls show that the public is less enamored of the punishment than it used to be. And frankly, when we ask the correct question, which is, after someone is convicted of first degree murder, which do you prefer, life with parole, life without parole, or the death penalty, we see a clear majority that favor the two life alternatives to death. So I want to start with the idea that the public is already less enamored of this punishment than many of our politicians think. Having said that, when I write these essays, I think I am particularly well suited to telling the truth. And so the truth involves an understanding of death penalty law and an ability to write in a way that communicates it without a bunch of footnotes and legal sites. So I started writing these essays because I thought the public wasn't getting the true story. You know, when you write about a lawyer that's drinking a quart of vodka a night, or prosecutors that are hiding evidence, you know, a lot of times that comes out in drips and drabs, and it doesn't come out in the context of a human story. So I started writing these essays to inform the public as best I could. At some point, I had enough of these essays, and I had written enough essays that weren't published, so that I thought that it made a compelling story, kind of a cover the waterfront type of story, where I had essays about prosecutorial misconduct and ineffective lawyers, racist judges. I tried to pick different topics in each of these essays. I try not to write the same essay topic more than once. And so you're right. It's a little episodic, but I think if you look at the essays carefully, you'd see that each one of them kind of covers a different topic. There is an overlap at some point, because when you see prosecutorial misconduct, you're often going to see ineffective lawyering as well. One leads to the other oftentimes.
Yeah. You know, I guess I don't want to literally go through every step of the way. I think we could talk about some of the major themes, and then you can kind of unpack some of it. One of the major problems raised in the book is the problem of judges. There are states, for instance, where a judge can apply a death sentence even after a jury has decided the defendant should get life in prison. Can you talk a little bit more about that problem?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I was just talking about how the public, I think, is not well informed of some of these issues. The first essay points out that a man named Buford White received a 12-0 vote for life from his jury. And there were very, very good reasons for that. Although the crime itself was horrific, White was pretty clearly not involved. I mean, he was involved to the extent of a robbery, but not to the extent of a murder. And he wanted no parts of it after that was done. And the jury heard this. And so they voted 12-0 for life. But in Florida at the time, that didn't stop the judge, a kind of a legendarily bad judge, from simply saying, "I don't care what the jury did." And he was executed shortly after that, a couple of years after that. So I think the public doesn't know that we still have situations where judges can overrule jury verdicts. Alabama has, I think there's two dozen people where a jury vote would have been for life. Either one juror or a number of jurors voted for life. And in most states, you require unanimity. So Alabama had a number of cases where the judge overruled the jury. The Supreme Court has had an opportunity to rectify that several times, but they've chosen not to do it. So I doubt that the public knows that in some states, the jurors, you know, jurors might vote one way, but a judge can still override it. It's remarkable.
So, you know, one of the areas in which this can become problematic, and you said before that maybe the public is less pro-death penalty than it would appear, but we also have, in theory, a problem of elected as opposed to appointed judges. Does this add to the problem, or is that not a big part of
the
problem?
No, it sure does. I think the Equal Justice Initiative, EJI in Alabama, did a study where they found that elected judges were more likely to be pro-death penalty, for lack of a better word, during election season when they were running for election. So, you know, I said that the death penalty doesn't have the same cachet it used to have. Certainly in some states it does. Alabama, I think it's fair to say, would be one of those states. In Pennsylvania, we had a justice of the Supreme Court, probably more than one, but one comes immediately to mind, and I wrote about him, where he campaigned on being the former district attorney of Philadelphia and putting 45 people on death row. So he actually ran for office and won a spot on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court by advertising his pro-death penalty, you know, bona fides. So yes, it makes a huge difference when we're electing judges who at least think that they can make some hay politically by being pro-death penalty. It's a big problem.
And another problem that it seems like we face is some regional tendencies. It seems like, in particular, it's very bad to be a person of color charged with a death-eligible sentence in the South. Is that fair, or?
I would say that that's more than fair, and I wouldn't limit it to the South. The book, if the book has one overriding theme, it's the persistence of racism in the death penalty. You see it all over the place. Racist lawyers, racist jurors, racist judges. And I think a lot of people, myself included, would suggest that the death penalty itself is kind of an outgrowth of lynching. When lynching went, you know, out of style, quote unquote, the death penalty arose. So, race discrimination is all over the death penalty. And it's not just the race of the defendant. It's also the race of the victim, which is, you know, a big issue. Study after study shows that you are more likely to get a death verdict if you kill a white person than a person of color. And of course, that's not how the system, you know, is designed. So, race just permeates every aspect of this, of capital punishment.
Yeah, I know when I talk about the death penalty, I usually say, you know, a brief set of arguments. The first one is that there are innocent people that get put on death, you know, on death row, and some theoretically executed. There's, you know, that it's massively racially disparate. And, you know, I've never seen any studies that dispute that. They all seem to reinforce that. And, you know, there's also obviously a lot of moral arguments. We've made some of those before. You know, in most, like you said, throughout permeates the entire book and the entire system, how the death penalty is applied in massively disparate ways. And there's kind of a systemic indifference to it in a lot of ways, all the way to the top. Do you have any kind of theories about how, you know, one of the things we said at the very beginning of this discussion is that the public might be turning back against the death penalty, but, you know, we have this kind of persistent kind of racist, you know, why do you think we have the persistence of this despite what you think are some changing public mores?
Yeah. Let me say one thing before I get specifically to that, which is that the reason that I think the death penalty is declining is because of knowledge. In other words, in the late 60s and early 70s, the public was against the death penalty in the same way. It just seemed like the wrong thing to do, but the public didn't know about certain things. So when the Supreme Court took the death penalty away, the public immediately responded by saying, "We want the death penalty. We, you know, don't take this away from us." Now, we have the same feelings against the death penalty, but we know a lot more. So this is what prompted this was your question about when you started out by talking about innocent people convicted and the race discrimination and so forth. We know more now than we knew in the late 60s and early 70s. We know about prosecutorial misconduct. We know about DNA. So we know about innocent people coming close to execution and in my opinion and in many other people's opinions, being executed. So we're much more knowledgeable. And that means that our views towards the death penalty are now getting much more support. Our views against capital punishment are getting much more support. So the question you ask is, why is it still there, basically? Why is it so difficult to eradicate? And I think to some extent, it's like turning around the Titanic. There's a certain inertia to the system. There are still victims who have been, in my opinion, misled by prosecutors who, you know, I mean, I don't want to speak for victims because every victim reacts differently. But I think that for many victims, closure proved to be a myth. With reversal after reversal, and the length of time that it takes between verdict and execution, the retrials and the resentencings we see, the ongoing litigation, I think for many victims, closure has been a myth. At the same time, there is this inertia that a verdict has been rendered and courts are hesitant to reverse those rulings, even when they're faced with pretty compelling evidence, like a couple of the essays in this book, a lawyer that drinks a quart of vodka a night, a juror that says, I'm imposing death, you know, because of the color of that defendant's skin, and I'm using not the words that he used. So you know, there is this hesitancy in a number of courts to reverse what they perceive as a public policy. I think, you know, Steve Bright, one of the great icons in my world, the one of the founders of the Southern Center for Human Rights, he said, and I love to quote him on this, that the last place the civil rights movement has reached is the courtroom. So I just think we're incredibly slow to read the tea leaves, and that the public is getting this idea. And I think a lot of politicians are getting this idea, at least the reform prosecutors that we're seeing elected, you know, in big cities are starting to get the idea. And the courtroom is the last place to get it. And so that's my explanation. They're just slow off the mark. I think they're going to get it, but it's a work in progress.
Another of the kind of problem areas that we talked about, you've brought it up a couple times already, is the idea of defense attorneys who either don't seem to care very much, don't have experience, are struggling with addiction, or are entirely out of their depth. But it seems kind of so normalized and yet so brutal that some people kind of by sheer bad luck get bad representation when their own life is on the line. So, you know, can you kind of add some color to, can you explain a little bit more about this problem?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we see over and over again that effective lawyering virtually ends the death penalty. I told you about the Defender Association. From 1993 to today, the Defender Association has not taken a single death verdict. And I think I attribute that not to the fact that the defender lawyers are the greatest lawyers in the world. I don't attribute it to that. I attribute it to the fact that they're effective. So by the same token, Virginia, a state that executed more people than any other state historically, they brought in regional capital trial lawyers. And those lawyers were well-trained, well-resourced, and because of that, they were effective. And over the course of 10, 11, or 12 years, they basically ended the death penalty in Virginia. There wasn't a single death verdict in Virginia. And because there wasn't a single death verdict, the legislature said, what are we throwing all this money away for? There's no point. And they ended the death penalty in Virginia. In my opinion, sheerly because of effective lawyering. So flip the coin. When you see lawyers appointed over and over, and I make this point in the book, you know, when you see bad lawyers appointed over and over, that's a system that is racist in its bottom, line. That is that the people that are subject to this awful lawyering, you know, the establishment does not care about those people. So a real system of justice would have an independent board that appointed lawyers and made sure they were qualified, not lawyers that drank a quart of vodka a night, you know, not lawyers that made racist jokes in the lawyers' lounge. And these are, you know, I'm using examples right out of the book. So a real system of justice makes sure that we don't appoint those lawyers. But when you see those lawyers appointed over and over again, and in Philadelphia, there were, you know, there was a hardcore group of 25, 30 court-appointed lawyers getting appointed over and over and over again, generating death sentence after death sentence. That's a system that doesn't care about justice. So, you know.
And what about the flip side of that? You know, I've known a few people who used to be death penalty prosecutors, and I think I would put my feeling about where they come from as kind of a very macabre kind of groupthink. What's your you've obviously been opposing these folks for a long time. So what's your kind of take on that?
So you know, it's interesting when I get asked to debate the death penalty. I always say the same thing. I say you're not going to find somebody to get on the other side. You know, the people that are still supporting this punishment after everything we know, DNA exonerations and prosecutorial misconduct, all the stuff we've been talking about, it's very hard to find people that are defending that system. So there's, you know, there's you know, three kinds of prosecutors. And, you know, one are the true believers. They just think an eye for an eye is fair. And you're not going to penetrate those prosecutors. There are other prosecutors who are just kind of, give me the file, tell me what to do, I'm going to do it, and we'll let the jury decide. And then there's the third kind of prosecutor who has kind of, you know, when you've done this work as long as I have, you see clients change. They change from very young guys who have oftentimes done some horrible things, and as they mature and as they kind of age out of violence, they're also aging into a mature worldview. You know, people that really have done enough time and should be released. And there's thousands of these guys. By the same token, you often see that in prosecutors. Prosecutors that do the work long enough are not zealous like they used to be. They come to a realization that maybe this isn't the best solution, that maybe life without parole or life with parole is a better answer. So, you know, I don't have a concrete answer for every prosecutor, but I've certainly run into a number of them that feel badly about the way they were as younger prosecutors, and they've aged out, they've matured, and they've come to see the light, frankly. I don't want to be too cliched about it, but that's how I see it.
And, you know, I think if there's one biggest problem of the ones that I noted outside of, you know, the systemic problems like racism, is appellate courts. At one point of the book, you quote a court decision suggesting whoever represents the accused has a far greater obligation than just standing around with a law license in his or her pocket. But to prevail on appeal, the condemned also has to show that if his lawyer hasn't done such a bad job, I lost the end of the quote there. But the point being that, you know, there should be an equal consideration in my mind for people at the appellate level as at the trial level and at any other level, if life is on the line, but that doesn't seem to be the way it works out. Do you have, you know, can you talk a little bit more about this?
Sure. The public has been misled for years, decades, about this kind of revolving door of justice, that every little technicality is letting murderers run out on the streets. It is the most deceptive media campaign, you know, ever conducted. The truth is that the law has very carefully been designed so that technicalities really screw the defendant, for, you know, pardon my language, but that's the reality. So you know, in the mid 90s, we passed a law called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. We refer to it as AEDPA, A-E-D-P-A. Yeah. And that's really what you're getting at with your question, which is that when decisions get made early in the process with bad lawyers that we've already talked about, those decisions kind of, you know, they're like getting etched in stone. They're like coming from Mount Sinai, and you can't under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, you can't disrupt those findings. So they get special deference. So what happens is bad lawyers handle the case early on, and then they handle the case on the first appeal. And then once that appeal comes down, that bad finding gets harder and harder to overturn because of the laws that we've set up. So, you know, while the public thinks everybody's getting out based on technicalities, it's actually exactly the opposite. There's a horrifying story in the book. It's not a standalone essay. It's just a reference where lawyers, a new case had come down, and the lawyers called the Justice Center, and they said, "Look, we're going to be there in a few minutes. We're having a problem with our printer." The head judge in Texas said, "Sorry, the court is closing at 5:00. Sure enough, those lawyers got there late. Their client got executed. A client then 2 days later with the same exact issue, he lived because of that issue. So this judge said, "We're closing the courthouse at 5:00. And the client got executed. Talk about your technicalities. It's horrifying. And the law supports this. And that judge who closed that courtroom, you know, years ago, she's still a judge in Texas. She's still a very important judge in Texas. So, you know, these technicalities are not setting anybody free.
Yeah, when Samuel Trivedi and I talk every year about the Supreme Court, on the podcast, you know, we've been talking about it as kind of this weird fetish of finality, that, you know, that even the Supreme Court seems to care much less if justice is done than they do about decisions being final. You know, they, you know, there are clear examples of where people have had injustice done to them in the service of finality, which is a very strange, especially when you're talking about death, you know, when you're talking about, you know, the penalty is literally death. You know, a couple terms ago, you know, you had Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, you know, kind of waxing poetic about how much of an annoyance all of this is, you know, when they were talking the cases about, you know, people not wanting, you know, wanting to use a, you know, a different cocktail than the one that it's just amazing to me that this happens. Why do you think there's so much, you know, at this top level where, you know, do justice or the heavens fall, you know, kind of level of the courts? Why is there this almost unbelievably cruel indifference happening, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, let me give the most obvious answer first, which is elections matter. Let's not make any bones about it. Anybody that still thinks that the United States Supreme Court is getting its answer out of law books hasn't been paying attention for forever, frankly. But certainly, you see evidence of this all over the place. So we've, you know, the plain fact is we've elected a string of of very conservative justices. We've elected them. We had an election, and then they got appointed through very, very, very partisan lines. So you start with that as a presumption. I think that, you know, to some extent, the law is a cover for people. That it, you know, if you want to do justice, you're going to find a way to do justice. I mean, read Justice Sotomayor's, you know, regular dissents on these issues. I mean, it's her writing is compelling in the extreme. But so if you want to do justice, there's a way to do it. And if you want to exercise finality and you want to see closure and you want to uphold death verdicts, there's a way to do that. And so, you know, the law provides cover for these justices to do that. I don't know any other way to put it. You know, I was talking the other day with some lawyers about victim impact evidence. Victim impact evidence is you put the victims on the stand in a penalty phase, and they get to talk about their loss. And the reason that that wasn't allowed for 100 years was because it emphasized the race of the victim. And as we've seen in study after study, the race of the victim shouldn't matter, but does matter in terms of who gets a death sentence. So for 100 years, we didn't want that evidence. And then so in 1987, there was an opinion that says, we don't want that evidence. In 1989, there's an opinion that says, we don't want that evidence. In 1991, that evidence is suddenly acceptable. And what was the change between 87, 89, and 91? Clarence Thomas got elected to the Supreme Court of the United States. The law didn't change. The law books did. The analysis didn't change, and the cases didn't change. The Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the United States Supreme Court changed, and that's, you know, that's the reality. It's who's on the court.
Another part that's pretty powerful in the book is discussing kind of how often mental illness plays into this. It almost seems like many judges seem to look at claims of mental illness as a ploy. And in one of the most disturbing stories in the book, there's a person named Andre Thomas who, you know, by any stretch of the imagination would have to be considered mentally ill, but kept getting denied kind of relief. Given what happened in that case and in others, is it even possible for anyone to be deemed mentally unfit to be put to death anymore?
So first, let me give you a tiny drop of good news before we get to all this, all the bad news that is inherent in your question. The good news is that Ohio just recently passed a law barring the execution of the severely mentally ill. So, you know, Ohio was, you know, it's not generally seen as a big front runner in these issues. So that's terrific. But you're so right that first, you know, the people that get through, you know, the safety net of the death penalty oftentimes. Now, I'm using safety net as a, maybe it's a bad metaphor, but if you've got good lawyers, you know, there are ways to avoid the death penalty oftentimes. And one way that we see that is problematic is severely mentally ill people that can't process information correctly. Now, Andre Thomas's case is different than that. So I'll get to that in a minute, but we routinely see, you know, severely mentally ill people where the court refuses to recognize their severe mental illness, and they end up with death sentences because they're just not able to process the information that's necessary for them to avoid it. Andre Thomas, on the other hand, is a profoundly mentally ill person, and I think his lawyers did a pretty ineffective job initially of showing that severe mental illness. There was a ton of it in the, and of course, you know, the essay just lays it out in extreme detail. But Andre Thomas is a profoundly mentally ill, and the fact that he not only let me just say this, not only was he found to be competent The district attorney said after he removed his eye that that was an impulsive act. A couple of years later, hopefully your listeners are sitting down. He removed his second eye and then ate it. I mean, we're talking about, he's now blind. We're talking about a profoundly mentally ill person. Not only has the court upheld his death verdict, but on another issue, which we'll get to in a second, I think, he's headed to the United States Supreme Court on a separate issue. And the Fifth Circuit, the court in Texas, they upheld his conviction and his sentence. Knowing how severely mentally ill he was, he's still facing execution, and his case is going to the United States Supreme Court this fall. The issue it's going on to the court on is...
Yeah, let's go ahead and jump right into that.
I might as well just jump right into it.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm sorry, but I'm rambling on
no,
here.
You're on it. You're on a roll. Let's go.
So the issue that he's actually going to the Supreme Court on is that Andre Thomas is an African-American man. He killed his white wife and two mixed race children. Amazingly, three jurors answered a questionnaire saying they were against interracial marriage. And the defense attorneys didn't ask two of them any questions at all. The third one, they asked some rudimentary questions. And these three jurors who were against interracial marriage sat in judgment on Andre Thomas's case and imposed a death verdict. So not only is the Thomas case significant for the most profound mental illness, but also for what I think is shocking race discrimination. So shocking that the dissent in that Fifth Circuit case had to cite Loving versus Virginia. That's a 50 or 60 year old United States Supreme Court case that condemned miscegenation laws. Who would think that in this day and age, you'd still have to point out Loving versus Virginia? But there you have it, in a dissent in the Fifth Circuit. So remarkable.
I would say there's a little bit of a mixed view of what times we're in right now. I think there are certainly, you know, I mean, let's be fair, there's a lot of backsliding and a lot of stuff going on right now.
Yes, you're right. You'd think that, I mean, look, people are willing to say, you know, amazing things. I mean, you go to these focus groups, like you say today, and you can't believe what some people are saying, you know, as if it's, you know, there's no problem at all with what they're saying. So you're right about that. But we have to at least hope that the justice system is, you know, a little bit more concerned with that sort of blatant racism than maybe, you know, some 30% of the population is. We have to hope for that anyway.
You know, to follow along kind of that line, I think a particularly cynical defender of the death penalty might read your book and say, kind of go through the checklist of things you bring up and say, okay, we could fix that, we could fix that, we could fix that, we could fix that. Okay, and now death penalty's okay. I don't think that's the argument you're making, so I figure I should at least present that as something that you could respond to.
Yeah, I think that's a fair analysis. There are a lot of things that can get fixed here. We're not gonna suddenly change the public from you know, being kind of what I think is fundamentally a racist society to non-racist. I don't think we're going to fix some things, but a pro-death penalty person would be right in saying we can, you know, what Bookman just said, let's have a neutral group of well-trained, well-resourced lawyers. Let's make sure that we're really scrutinizing our jurors. We're not going to elect judges. We're going to appoint them and be very, very careful about the process. We're going to have open files so that the prosecutor can't hide any evidence. All those things could happen. And for those things to happen, we're going to have to spend a huge amount of money. So this is one thing that I didn't mention in that Yale Law Journal article when I talked about the defender a representation and how advantageous it was if you got one of those lawyers. The RAND Corporation also found that during that 11-year period, if you had a defender, you would the public, if the defenders had represented everybody, the public would have saved over $200 million in excess incarceration costs. So I'm on the podcast, the Decarceration Nation. We would have saved that 24% lower sentence. We would have saved the public more than $200 million. So if we make a decision that the death penalty is the most important public policy we can possibly have, contrary to deterrence and arbitrariness and racism, we want the death penalty more than any other thing. It's going to cost a huge amount of money that could go to schools or roads or even a well-funded policing. So I can't imagine, moral issues aside, race aside, accidents aside, I can't believe that we're going to make a decision that the number one issue we want to focus on is having the death penalty, not better schools or better roads or you know, climate change addressing. So I think that's fair. If we want to spend that inordinate amount of money, we can fix a lot of the aspects of the death penalty. Not all of them, but a lot of them. I can't believe as a public policy, we would make that decision.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I wish I, you know, had the kind of listenership that, say, a Joe Rogan has or something like that. Let's pretend for a second that I did.
And on the other hand, you're probably well vaccinated, and we don't have to.
I am well vaccinated.
We'll have that battle anyway.
I am well vaccinated, and I'm ready to take the booster as soon as they want to give it to me. I got no problem with it. So, pretending for a second we had that kind of worldwide, you know, reach. You know, I mean, part of this is a public policy question, and part of this is a problem, a question of how the public reacts. We've talked about that a bunch of times. You know, but right now, you know, we have a bunch of people who are still about to get executed in the status quo. And the typical way that the public goes about dealing with that right now is there's a campaign, there's a bunch of people who push around a bunch of memes, a bunch of people sign petitions, a bunch of people show up in protest. And unfortunately, the people still end up getting killed. So do you have any theories on how, you know, we can combine the lessons of the book, getting to more people, getting to the right people, and moving governors to stop executing people? You've been watching this for a long time. I'm certainly not denigrating any of the organizing work anyone's done. It's just, I think, for all of us, very frustrating that, you know, we haven't been able to stop more executions than we have, unfortunately. Although a lot of executions have not happened, as you've mentioned before, they've been going down.
And, you know, when I was younger, I was much more naive. I mean, the death penalty seemed so clearly inappropriate to me that I couldn't believe the public wouldn't, you know, come to the same conclusion quickly. And I had these delusions, for lack of a better word, you know, at a time when the death penalty was very, very popular. I'm not that naive anymore. But I will say this, all signs, you know, point in the right direction. So what the first order of business is that we have to recognize, again, the royal we have to recognize that we're no longer in the minority. We're in the majority, and we have to start acting like it. So, you know, you see reform prosecutors getting elected across the country. I want to say again, when a Gallup poll gets asked about whether you're in favor of the death penalty, it's about 55% right now. That's the wrong question. When we ask, what sentence would you prefer for someone who's been convicted of first degree murder, and you list the alternatives, the death penalty is no longer a majority position. So we're now in the majority, and we have to stop acting like martyrs and start acting like majoritarians. Having said that, we just got rid of the death penalty in Virginia, the most execution prone state in the country. Utah, the blood atonement state, is now strongly considering getting rid of the death penalty. Six leading prosecutors came forward in Utah and said, let's get rid of it. So we're making headway across the country. And it's a combination of things. It's It is organizing, but it's also knowledge. And again, you know, this is why I wrote the book. I think we are so much more knowledgeable now. And when you read these essays or you know, other books that talk about it. I know you had Maurice Chama on at some point. You know, if you read these books, then you draw a certain conclusion, and that conclusion is we know more now than we ever used to know, and you're seeing it steadily. We've got governors, you know, I mean, it's not happening tomorrow, but I'm old enough to know that this kind of change is not going to happen tomorrow, but it's going to happen sooner than we think, because we're heading downhill now. I mean, downhill in a good way. You know, it's like the running back running downhill in a football game. We've got momentum on our side. The public doesn't love it anymore. The prosecutors are starting to get over it. Governors are imposing moratoriums. So, you know, your premise is, I think we're not making headway. And my opinion is we're making more headway than it seems. And, you know, it's incremental, but it's steady. If we can win Utah and we can win Virginia, Ohio, we're making big headway.
This year, I'm asking people if there are any criminal justice related books they might recommend to others. Do you have any favorites?
Yeah. Talking about Utah, this is not a new book. It's a book by Michael Gilmore, the brother of Gary Gilmore, the first person executed in the modern era in Utah. He wrote a book called Shot in the Heart. Michael Gilmore is a Rolling Stone writer. He's an actual writer, and Gary was his brother. Shot in the Heart is a terrific book about the death penalty in Utah. And speaking of Gary Gilmore's execution, Norman Mailer, this is just coming off the top of my head, I can't think of the name of the book now. Norman Mailer wrote a book about Gary Gilmore as well. I think the best writing about the death penalty is The Closing Argument by Clarence Darrow in the Leopold and Loeb case. It's lengthy. I think he spoke for 2 days. And amazing.
That's lengthy.
Amazing closing argument. 2 days, 12 hours, I think he spoke. And so the arguments of Clarence Darrow is a book. And you read that closing argument and you come away saying, I think the death penalty is a great idea. You're impenetrable. You know, you can't be reached. So I would suggest Shot in the Heart and The Closing Arguments of Clarence Darrow. I know neither of those is a new book. I was listening to Maurice's podcast, and he recommended another terrific book, Amongst the Lowest of the Dead in Florida, a book about the history of the death penalty in Florida. That's a great book as well. So
great. I always ask the same last question. What did I mess up? What question should I have asked but did not?
Josh, I actually feel like you were on a roll.
well, thank you.
I really thought that you touched on everything. I think that, you know, we didn't talk about the moral aspects of the death penalty. And, you know, I don't know if you want me to.
Sure, go ahead.
The moral aspect of the death penalty is, you know, I mean, when I was just starting out, I had no, you know, I had no fundamental ideas about DNA exonerations or prosecutorial misconduct. I just had a sense that it was wrong. And so I like to tell the story about the Lion King as a kind of an allegory about the death penalty. People that remember the Lion King, which I watched with my kids a million times, Scar is the heinous criminal in the story, and he kills Mufasa, who is a benevolent leader of the lion pride. And then he compounds the horrible crime. It's a horrible crime. He intentionally kills Mufasa, and he does it to promote himself to the head of the tribe. And then he compounds it by blaming Simba, the Mufasa's son. And so it's really an awful crime. And Simba grows up to be an adult lion. He's always thought he was responsible for his father's death. He learns that he wasn't, and he confronts Scar, in a lion-like trial, and he ends up winning that trial. They rumble around in the dust, and Simba ends on top of Scar, and Scar says, "What are you going to do now, Simba? Are you going to kill me?" And I remember stopping the tape for my six-year-old, and I said, "What do you think Simba should say?" And my six-year-old said, "Well, it's not nice to kill people, even if they're mean." And of course, Simba doesn't do that. Simba bans Scar from the community, kind of a life punishment. And so, you know, I like to imagine if Simba said, "Yes, Scar, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to strap you down. I'm going to, you know, buckle your hands, and then I'm going to inject you with poison until you're dead." What would the parents and the kids do watching that movie? They'd go running out of the theater, screaming in horror that Simba would do that, because a good person doesn't do that. And that's the message Clarence Darrow makes as well, that we should not be acting like a heinous murderer acts. We're better than that. And so, you know, from a moral point of view, when someone says, "Show them the same mercy they showed the victim," that's an absurd phrasing of the question, because we should not be acting like heinous murderers. And that's what the death penalty is. That's the, you know, that's why I called the book A Descending Spiral. I was quoting Martin Luther King, and I don't want to blow it, so I'm going to read it exactly. "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy." You know, that's what the death penalty is all about. So thank you for that opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, you know, I've always just said, you know, it's sort of a short form of that, you know, being for the death penalty says more about us than it says about them. And, you know, so I couldn't appreciate that story anymore. Is there anywhere in particular you would like for people to find your book, or is there a website or anything that you'd like to
put? I wouldn't want to enter that political issue, but they can go to the New Press. The New Press is a nonprofit progressive publisher. I'm very, very proud to be published by the New Press, and they can go there and Google A Descending Spiral and New Press, and they'll find the book.
Great. And it's thanks again for doing this. It's really been great to talk to you and to get to know you a little bit. And, you know, best of luck with the book.
I appreciate it.
And now, my take. On October 26th, I'll be hosting a webinar featuring criminologist and economist John Pfaff. We'll be discussing the increase in homicides, domestic violence, and other violent crime across the country in context, and addressing many of the claims made as to the causes of this spike in violence. While the 2022 elections fast approaching, we are soon to be inundated by scaremongering in the media and in political ads, and now is the best and probably most important time to separate fact from fiction. I will include a registration link in the notes for the podcast, but I think this will be a critical toolbox for all of the people who are interested in reform of our criminal legal system, but have been overwhelmed by all the tough-on-crime talking points and relentless messaging from aggressive press outlets, police, police unions, and prosecutors' associations. I hope you will join us for what I believe will be a very informative, hour-long discussion. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/decarcerationnation. For those of you who prefer a one-time donation, you can now go to our website and give a one-time donation. Thanks to all of you who have joined us from Patreon or who have given a donation. You can also support us in other non-monetary ways by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or add us on Stitcher, Spotify, or from your favorite podcast app. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, to Ann Esmo for helping with our transcripts and social media messages, and to Alex Mayo, who helps with our website. Make sure and add us on social media and share our posts across your networks. Also thanks to my employer, Safe and Just Michigan, for helping to support the Decarceration Nation podcast. And also remember, you can now watch the episodes of the podcast on YouTube. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.